This is the Popmatic Podcast for May 4th, 2016.
Mother!
This is the Popmatic Podcast, coming to you from Studio NPL in the heart of downtown Nashville. This is where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Mac.
Amanda.
Bill.
Jeremy.
This Sunday is Mother's Day. Moms! Now, appropriately enough, the current Nashville Reads title is The Color of Water by James McBride. The Color of Water is a memoir about McBride's amazing mother, Ruth. Even better, Mr. McBride will be at the library Monday, May 9th at 6:15 p.m. at the main library downtown. McBride is a musician, and this event will also be a concert, and you can get your book signed. Be there or be square. Now, our favorite mothers, and probably a little bit about Prince.
Ryan.
Want to have an awkward conversation about mothers?
Sure. When I was a small boy, probably 6 or 7, I felt a lot of stress. I was struggling with my lip-syncing career. I didn't win tickets to see Bon Jovi. And the teenage girl on my church bus didn't feel the same way about me that I felt about her.
How old were you?
I was 6 or 7. And because my parents were such good role models, I had an idea of how to handle that stress. I asked my mom if I could start smoking. The plan was to stick with menthols, because menthol was obviously some kind of medicine, much healthier than what my mom smoked. But she said
no. Well, it isn't cough drops.
You know. Yeah. Well, see, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that was my justification.
That confused me for so long.
Yeah. So, of course, she said no. Shocker. And the remainder of my first decade of life was spent mainlining Mountain Dew and Mad Magazine. Now that I'm a parent, I know this
you're
was
mainlining Mountain Dew.
I was mainlining it. I was
no, mainlining. Now you're doing it as an adult.
Oh yeah, I'm freebasing it. I don't, those things might not be different.
He's progressed.
Yeah, yeah.
I only do it on the weekends and quit anytime I want. Now that I'm a parent, I know this was an unreasonable request, but thanks to punk rock, I know it could have been a lot worse. Some kids want to smoke. Some kids just want a Pepsi, and others, like Glenn Danzig, want to go out and kill. You might remember Glenn Danzig from Mike and Me singing his early 90s hit Mother, over the course of many episodes. Nice. Or perhaps you've seen him schlepping kitty litter in your Facebook feed. But we must never forget that Danzig was the frontman for the seminal horror punk band The Misfits. The band formed in New Jersey in 1977 and are still performing to this day, though bassist Jerry Only is the band's only original member.
Yes.
Nope.
It's not
an unintentional pun. The Danzig era Misfits are the best, of course, and it's from this dark cauldron from which Mommy, Can I Go Out and Kill Tonight emerged.
Mommy, can I go out and kill tonight?
This is from the band's debut full-length, 1982's Walk Among Us, which would have been the band's second album, but the 1978 recorded Static Age wasn't released in its entirety until the mid-1990s. You can find all this and more on Hoopla. So what is this song about? Well, you know how sometimes a song title doesn't really have anything to do with what the song is about? This is not one of those cases. This is a kid gets bullied in school, but he does his homework, puts his nose to the grindstone to do a great job, and then he goes out and kills all those people who have scorned him, and he brings back parts of their bodies as trophies for his mother. Cool. It's a bloodier, more depraved version of the mother-son dynamic found in Psycho, and it's an inversion of the one found in Friday the 13th. The song was recorded live in a setting which sounds about as violent as the song. And really, all the stuff that the song is about, I knew the only words that I really knew was like, can I go out and kill tonight? Because it's like...
So yeah, sounds like punk, yeah.
It totally rules. So I was, when I was first exposed to this band, I was always kind of turned off by their sound because, like, I liked all the ideas going on, you know. But their records weren't, you know, I'm not saying they're big ideas. Their records weren't produced by Timbaland or whoever is a good producer, and their guitar sound.
Rick Rubin.
Yes. Yeah, their guitar sound. Would kind of range from like thin and out of tune to like fuzzier than Leftovers and Mike's Fridge. And there was also a sort of this.
It's a sick freezer burn.
Yeah. there's also a sort of a hilarious seriousness about the band, which I kind of love. It really contrasts with all the B-movie imagery they employ in their appearance and their songs. They're kind of like a punk rock Kiss, which sounds like an insult. But isn't because Kiss rules in their own way. Sometimes both bands are cartoons, but Kiss is kind of like Scooby Doo, and the Misfits are more Johnny Quest or whatever contemporary cartoon is cool. Because apparently I only know 50-year-old cartoons. I prefer tunes like Last Caress, Bullet, and Where Eagles Dare, all of which cover topics unsuited for a podcast about moms. Unlike the one that I'm actually recommending. But I recommend on Hoopla, if you're not familiar with the band, checking out the compilation collection, which features material from the band's EPs and singles, and maybe just avoid all the non-Danzig stuff. Also, don't smoke and don't kill your enemies. Amanda?
Wow.
Stay in school, kids.
Drugs are bad. So some authors are like old friends. They weave their way in and out of your life, popping up once every 2 years or so. And while they're with you, it's almost like they never left, and they seem to fit seamlessly into your existence. And then book finish, mission accomplished, they fade away again to be almost forgotten until the next installment. And Joshua Jackson is one of those authors for me. I always get really excited when she puts out a new book, even if I can't get to reading it right away. I know it's there waiting for me to remember it, and I think my subconscious savors the anticipation. I hope that happens. I'm not just ignoring it. In 2014, Jackson released Someone Else's Love Story, which I promptly put on my Kindle. There it sat. It sat.
Gathering e-dust.
The e-dust, yeah. the dreaded e-dust. Yeah. Until...
bites.
Oh. Until recently, I finally decided to finish it. In Love Story, we meet Shandy Pierce, who's a single young mother raising her 3-year-old son, Natty, while trying to finish college. Natty is uber precocious and was conceived under somewhat questionable circumstances. We also meet William Ash, who is a sexier and more athletic version of Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory. He's really smart like that. And Shandy and William are thrown together in a burglary at a Circle K in Georgia, so pick your road stops.
Oh, well.
Wisely.
Okay. I like that you said a sexier version of that Sheldon guy, as if he were already sexy. There was like some sort of baseline sexiness.
I'm sure some women somehow find that attractive, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it depends.
Amy Farrah Fowler seems to like it.
Oh, so. Sure.
Men with no emotions, yeah, you know.
So, you know, overall this sounds fairly predictable, I know, but Jackson weaves several different stories and timelines together in a way that makes complete sense. Someone Else's Love Story focuses on Shandy's role both as a mother to Natty and as an individual who is falling in love with William. Unfortunately, William has his own demons, facing the death of his daughter and loss of his wife in a tragic car accident. We also meet Shandy's long-divorced mother, who is still in love with her ex, Shandy's dad, who remarried a stepmonster of epic proportions. So there's lots of excellent character development here to twist and weave together a lot of mother-daughter relationships. Jackson also spins William's best friend, Paula, into her own mother-daughter mess in her most recent book, The Opposite of Everything, which that just came out a couple months ago, which is why I read the other one, because I had to read this one, so... It all worked out in the end. I didn't like The Opposite of Everything quite as much as the love story, but it was fun to revisit familiar characters. Plus, if Jackson keeps writing, I'll keep reading. And I've mentioned the Rosie Project on the podcast for a different Tickle My Fancy segment. This one reminded me a lot of that, except awesomer without all the Aussies. Sorry, Gary.
Oh, Gary from Perth.
Wait, that wasn't the Rosie effect.
Is just Australian.
Yeah, but I'm saying you weren't making a pun like awesomer and
No, I was not on purpose.
That's
unintentional. A little bit. Yeah, you can. Yeah, hey, that's like taffy girl. You can stretch it.
Put that on the Barbie.
So I love Jocelyn Jackson. I'm happy I finally finished this one. And you, if you haven't read her, you need to check her out now.
That's like taffy girl. You can stretch it.
I'm sorry, I called you girl.
And Ryan wins. Oh, yeah, see, you know, you decry our puns, but you join us.
I think he was making fun of me for saying, I'm sorry, I called you girl. That's insulting.
I'll cry later.
I wasn't trying to tell you.
Jocelyn Jackson's title game is down a little bit, I think, because when she first started, her titles of her books were like,
just yeah, like, I'll give you that.
Boom. Her previous titles include Backseat Saints and A Grown-Up Kind of Pretty. So, anyway, Bill.
Take us, you know, to something completely different.
Well, on Mother's Day, what do I want to talk about? Maybe I remember Mama, starring Irie Dunne as Mama, in which she plays a matriarch of an immigrant Norwegian family and its ups and downs in 1910. Or Leave It to Beaver with Barbara Billingsley as June Cleaver, a mother who could take care of a house, a husband, two boys, all the while wearing a dress, high heels, and a pearl necklace. But of course, with my demented mind, the first mother I thought of was Angela Lansbury's portrayal of Mother in 1962's movie The Manchurian Candidate, directed by John Frankenheimer.
Yeah. Go to that ladies' flower club meeting, guys.
Yeah.
Past the time playing a little solitaire.
Yeah. Queen of Hearts.
Angela Lansbury portrays Eleanor Iceland, or as she's referred to in the movie as Mother, who is literally in the driver's seat of her husband's political career, a buffoonish senator played by James Gregory, inspired by the real-life Senator Joseph McCarthy. All the while, she manipulates her son, Raymond Shaw, played by Lawrence Harvey. And like I said, he never calls her by name. He always says mother. And when he does say mother, it's like in the most sarcastic,
disgusting,
hated, demented way.
The mother.
It really is. And here's an interesting fact. Angela Lansbury was only 3 years older than Lawrence Harvey when she played his mother.
It's like my dad.
Yeah, he was born in 1990. Miracle of science.
Callback.
The Manchurian Candidate was released in 1962, and one of its plot points is about assassination. Not trying not to give too much away for those of you who haven't seen it yet, Amanda. Soon after the release, the Manchurian Candidate, President Kennedy, was assassinated, and it was really a hard movie to see. Frank Sinatra owned the movie, and he was close to the Kennedy family. Anyway, you couldn't see the movie for a long time. It was one of those movies that you read about. It was great, but you can't find it.
Sinatra was also in the movie,
yeah,
too.
Sinatra
was the star. Yeah.
He was amazing in it, too.
Yeah.
Very good.
And until the late 1980s, when it was re-released into theaters and home video. Another fun fact, at the time of the re-release, The Manchurian Candidate, Angela Lansbury was the biggest star on television because she was in Murder, She Wrote, a character 100% opposite of her role in The Manchurian Candidate. In an interview, I remember distinctly Angela Lansbury said about her performance, "Well, it's not Murder, She Wrote." So people who went into this movie, young fans, were totally shocked by this characterization that she came up with. And so my final comments is just check out the 1962 version of The Manchurian Candidate to see Angela Lansbury play one of the biggest mothers of them all.
Don't walk off a short pier, gang.
When I saw that movie in college, we watched it in a film class, and I only knew her. I knew her from Murder, She Wrote, and I had also seen Bedknobs and Broomsticks, so like the kid stuff. And then, but I also knew her from Sweeney Todd as Mrs. Lovett. So I knew like a little bit of like a darkness in her or whatever. But then I saw that movie and was like just blown away by how scary she is. And
she's like creepy the whole time. Oh, it's kind of sleazy.
The whole movie like is just mind blowing. Just fantastic.
I have not seen this movie either.
Oh, nice.
Amanda.
guys.
So
really?
The reason I haven't seen it, even though I know it is often studied in film classes and stuff, is because Frank Sinatra's in it, and I don't care.
Oh, you don't like Frankie?
See, I don't find him as a singer interesting in any way, but yeah. I think he actually pulled off in this.
He's not like...
No, not at all.
He's not Frank Sinatra.
It was a very good year when I didn't listen to Frank Sinatra.
Well, I'm pretty sure he came up with the line... I had a dream last night, Doc, and it was a real swinger. I think he improvised that line.
Yeah, that sounds like Frankie.
He's very good at it, though.
Yeah.
Oh, that ending.
So,
Mike.
What ending?
Yeah, I too saw it in college.
Manchurian Candidate is a book, too, right?
Mm-hmm. By Richard Condon.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah. Wait, all I don't know means I didn't read it?
No, I didn't read it.
Okay, I didn't read it either. Okay, I didn't read it either. What are we going to talk about today?
I own a copy of it, but I've also not read it.
Yeah, I wonder if it's any good. Don't stay away from the Denzel Booby Gang, because that one's really lame.
We won't go there. That's why I would keep saying 1962. Yeah.
The original, the classic version. So, you know, unlike everybody else, I didn't go with a pop culture mom. I went for the most important mom in my life, my mom. Long-time listeners may have noticed that I rarely mentioned my mother on this show. Well, to be honest... we don't have a lot in common. For instance, she can be quite vain and arrogant, while I am the most humble person who's ever lived on the planet Earth. I walked here on a plane of water. Oh, kneel before me, peons. But one thing we do have in common is a love of movies. When I was a boy, she would regale me with tales of old-timey Hollywood, and she would make a point of introducing me to classic films like Casablanca and North by Northwest. Every year, we watch the Oscars, and since I've moved away, she calls me the week of the Oscar nominations, and we discuss what should have been nominated, and, like, on the night of the Oscars, we text back and forth the whole time. It's adorable. And so, I thought it'd be neat on this Mother's Day episode to recommend her favorite movie ever, A Man for All Seasons. A Man for All Seasons is about Thomas More, advisor to Henry VIII of England. At the beginning of the movie, he learns from Cardinal Wolsey, who's played by a clearly slumming at Orson Welles, who like is practically reading off a cue card the whole time, that Henry seeks to divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon, and marry Anne Boleyn. And maybe More could help him out? To which More says, nope. More then is approached by a young man named Rich, who's played by John Hurt in the movie that made his in the role that made his career, looking for government work, to which More says, nope. And in the next scene, a suitor asks for his daughter's hand in marriage and asks for Moore's permission, to which Moore says, nope.
Moore,
I see a theme. Yeah, geez, you know, he says no in this movie more often than anything else. Moore
has to be a man for all reasons to justify all those no's.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, he's Moore is a paragon of moral virtue, moral, say, and steadfast in his beliefs, to which we'll see, you know, a culmination later on. The king himself goes to visit Moore, who's played by Robert Shaw, you know, Quint from Jaws, and my favorite bank robber in the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, haha, to plead for himself in obtaining a divorce, to which Moore says, nope. By this time, Moore has been named Chancellor, and since he refuses to help Henry, villainous Thomas Cromwell, who's played by like Leo McKern, my favorite number two. Seriously, this is like a masterclass at British actors in the mid-60s. It's amazing. Sees an opening for advancement, mwahaha. Through some heavy machinations, which I won't go to for time reasons, he devises an oath declaring Henry VIII as the head of the Church of England. Moore refuses to not only say the oath, but he even like doesn't even talk during his eventual trial for treason. He's eventually executed for his beliefs, while Rich and Cromwell essentially do a high five in the background. Huzzah. Yay, evil. I watched this movie last year after reading Wolf Hall, and it was an interesting case in contrast. In Wolf Hall, Moore is more of a selfish jerk who martyrs himself because he feels he is better than everyone else, including his own family. And in there, Thomas Cromwell is a pragmatic, self-made man who tries to do what's right. It's kind of fun seeing a sharp, you know, contrast opposite stuff. You know, what is considered a hero in the mid-60s, what is considered a hero today. Because, you know, back then, if you wanted to see someone who you wanted to see somebody who was better than you on screen, but nowadays you just want to see somebody who's exactly like you, you know, maybe like a drug or addict lower. Or a murderer. Or, yeah.
I don't know Kardashian. If I'm anything like the Thomas Cromwell in Wolf Hall, but I was just going to say that I think that Wolf Hall is really good literature and really good TV, but it's revisionist history for sure.
Yeah. It was interesting reading like the Wikipedia because I was like, Thomas Cromwell, is he related to Oliver Cromwell? Yes, he is. And it turns out that, whoa, in real life, he's considered quite a jerk. And that's what part of the appeal of Wolf Hall was for, like, British people, is, like, seeing Cromwell, like, as the hero. Lastly, I do find it kind of odd this is my mom's favorite movie, since she finds Heavenly Moral Heroes super duper boring. Oh, geez.
It took me years. Too. That's why I don't watch it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
Yeah, totally. It took her years to see Captain America, and she thought I was super lame for liking, you know, Captain America the Winter Soldier. I'm like, but mom, it's a 70s spy movie. And she's like, man, I'm not seeing any of that crap. And then she saw it. She's like, that was amazing. I'm like, yeah, I know. I think that maybe since it came out when she was 13, it's like me in the 1989 version of Batman. When I saw it when I was so young, that things would bug me as an adult don't matter. I'll still love it forever and ever.
Hey, man.
What do you have, Brian?
I'm going yard. And I'm going to talk about The Color of Water by James McBride. Okay, so here's the hook. McBride's mother was a Jewish immigrant that ended up growing up in Suffolk, Virginia in the 1930s, which was no cakewalk. It was like KKK ran everything. They were the only Jewish family. It was crazy, horrible. But even more interesting, she ends up marrying a black guy and moving to New York. Flash forward, she ends up in a housing project in Red Hook, Brooklyn, single with 12 mixed race kids. And most of these kids went on to be overachieving Ivy Leaguers. Ruth McBride, James McBride's mother, was a very special person. And I'm going to tell you, this book was so much better than I thought it would be. We read it in my book club because it was a Nashville Reads title, and it made me cry on the bus. And that's my new standard for books now. Like,
one tier or two? This guy's zero tiers. I don't care.
Does it make me cry on the bus? But then
I've heard you talk about books that make you cry on the bus before, and I think that should be a good standard.
That's totally the standard, like whether I cry on the bus. And I guess one of the things related to the crying on the bus is, like, depending on who I'm sitting around, do I want them to see me cry? Which is a completely different social experiment, right?
The dude with the knife or the mother holding a baby with a knife?
Okay, so this woman is this white lady who has 12 kids, most of which sort of like read as African-American. And, you know, so there's a lot of conversation in the book about race in America. There's just so many interesting anecdotes and stories in the book, and how she got to end up having 12 kids, you know, living in Brooklyn is just, you know, truth is stranger than podcasts. But one really good, interesting story, little teaser that I'll give you is, at one point, her and her husband start a Baptist church in their living room, and they grow it from scratch. And eventually it becomes like a church with a proper building and everything outside of their house. And it's like your typical black Baptist church of what you think of, right?
Amen.
And then later in life, you know, she moves away and she's not involved in the church anymore. But then the church is still going and thriving. But then she comes back. And it's really great. James McBride is a great writer, but he writes about how this, like, this old white Jewish lady comes back to this, like, black Baptist church in Brooklyn. And like, guess what? She's the founder. It's just like, that's just like one really good story in it as well. And, you know, it was funny was in my book club, even though in many ways this is a love letter to his mother, what we ended up talking about in book club is the ways that she actually was like a bad mother and kind of a nutcase. Because if you're a single parent and you have 12 kids, like, you cannot be a helicopter parent, right? Like, there's like a delineation of duties and like what makes you be able to survive and keep it all together. In a lot of ways, you know, her just fanatical, obsessive, like, rigidness that, like, fueled her household also is, like, also perhaps a character flaw that wouldn't work in other situations, but it worked well in the situation that she was in at a time. It was a fascinating book. I really recommend it. And if you can, come to Mr. McBride's talk here at the library. It'll also be a concert. He is a composer and a musician. Should be fantastic. That's Monday, May 9th at 6:15. Check it out. If you haven't read the book yet, for real, it is really good.
Well, I was just going to say, I read it too, just because of this, and I have spent a lot of time not liking the Nashville Reads picks, but I loved this one. I thought this one was awesome.
Yeah, I read the first page, much like Jeremy and It, I guess, or Gravity's Rainbow, Future Correction. And the first page or two is like really gripping.
Well, I need to read more of this. The format was like his mom would tell a story, and then he would tell a story, and then his mom would tell a story, and he would tell. So it went back and forth. It had two voices in it. And a lot of the stuff was stuff he didn't even know. And so I've done a lot of genealogical stuff with my family. And so that was interesting to me on that level. But yeah, the part where she, like, they move 1,000 times. So packing up as a single woman, moving children, a thousand, like, and just because she's like, I don't want to live here. So like, they're going to move, then they're not going to move, then they're going to move, then they're not going to, and I'm just like, dude.
This is like my mother.
That was the part that her,
just because she got bored.
She was just so scattered that she couldn't afford to live where she was living. And so they had to like relocate, and like the sisters didn't want to leave New York and the brothers did. I mean, it was just, she was kind of a little bit scattered on that, but Bernard said it worked out for her, so. But it did remind me, I was going to say, it reminded me of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks that I've mentioned at some point by Rebecca. It's kind of that same setup, but I thought that's what, when I was reading, I kept thinking, reminded me of that.
Yeah, and you were talking about the structure of it, how it goes back and forth. I didn't mention this, but it's also, I mean, a short biography of James McBride, too, or at least his youth.
He weaves it into.
Yeah, yeah. Like growing up in that sort of very, like.
Because he was child number 8 of 12. Yeah. So he came in at the, towards the end.
Chaotic household. And then another minor spoiler, like his father died when he was an infant.
Before he was born.
Oh, see, I'm so confused. Yeah,
like he was the last of the original.
Of the original dad. But it reads like an oral history, which are often like very easy to read. So the chapters that are about Ruth are in her voice, and I think they're probably, you know, transcribed, but probably polished up a little bit from, you know, just recordings that McBride made with his mother. And, you know, books like that, if you've ever read those, like, oral history of...
You know, like Studs Terkel and...
I was going to say, like, oral, I mean, the ones that I read now are, like, music books. So it's, like, oral history of some music scene or whatever. Yeah. It just reads like that. And those are, like, really quick and easy to read. And
Yeah, I read it in, like, 2 days.
Yeah. Probably a really good choice for a citywide read because of that. So.
But it was funny because he was saying, like, he quit his job at some... like Washington Post or some big publication to write this book. He thought, 2 weeks, like 6 months. He took like 6 years to get his mom to actually sit down and do this. She was just like, because she didn't care because it was just so hard for her to go back to when she was Jewish.
Like a Holocaust survivor or something?
Her family was. Like her, like she, because she was from Poland and so they immigrated when she was like 2.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but she did lose family. But like she just was like, oh, it doesn't matter, doesn't matter. Like she just didn't want to. Because they sat, her family, when she got married, her family sat Shiva for her. And said the Kaddish. So, I mean, like, she was dead to them, basically.
Whoa. Big spoiler. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story of how she, like, ends up not being involved in a Jewish community and being embraced by the black community in New York. It's a really interesting story. Hey, guys.
What is it, Brian?
Hey, Brian.
Yes, Brian.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well... maybe the library has it.
Has it?
Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
For sure.
That was loud.
So, I don't know if this is tickling our fancy per se, but Prince has passed, and in pop culture, he is royalty. Is that a terrible pun?
It's not a pun.
So I think we would be remiss if we did not share some of our thoughts of Prince. And then later there are some of our podcastees are true Prince believers that will probably cry on mic in future episodes. But for now, our thoughts of Prince Rogers Nelson.
Thank you, Brian. I came late to Prince, even though I grew up at a time when he was sort of at his peak. So when I got older and was listening to music, I sort of only associated him with the 1980s. I thought he was only good like in an ironic way, like sort of like you would listen to Sister Christian or something like that, like on a jukebox. You're like, yeah, motoring, you know,
what's your price for flight?
Exactly. Like I just sort of lumped him in with that sort of whole era, even though I think I knew it was like, wait, he's sort of going all across the board here.
I never lumped Prince in with those guys.
I'm not saying he was like that, but I'm just saying like I associated him with that era only, as if he were only good in that context. You know what I mean?
He was a sex obsessed R&B singer. He's the okay.
Oh, hey, maybe that's where I'm going with this. I don't know.
Spoiler
could be.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry.
I very clearly though remember loving the song You Got the Look, which was like a duet with Sheila E. Sheena Easton. I always get those two confused.
Yeah, I am confused.
It's Sheena Easton. Sheila E. is a drummer.
New York folks, treat me all dreamer.
But I also got kind of creeped out by it because this was at a time when Prince was singing with this speeded up voice. Like his voice, I guess, was processed in studio. He was working on something called the Camille album, which he was going to release under the name Camille, and that never got released. So that kind of creeped me out. And there's also there's something, this weird instrumental flourish at the end that kind of scared me. But I think what I was afraid of was maybe the overt sexuality in both his music and his persona. Much later, I really loved the song Seven. From the Love Symbol album. It's got the symbol that he went by for a while. But this was at a point in his career when he was moving away from all the sexiness and reconnecting with his spiritual life. But there was no erasing sexiness from his performance. He was a tiny but mighty personification of the very idea of sexiness, which is maybe why, as a child, I didn't process him as good. And maybe it took me understanding that stuff better.
I like that you're wearing a purple lanyard in mourning.
Oh, I always wear a purple lanyard. Purple is probably one of my favorite colors. Rest in peace, Prince.
Well, much like David Bowie, I had like a pretty much one and done. You know, I had like the one album I really liked that true fans didn't like. So speaking of 1989's Batman, which I mentioned earlier, today...
Which you mentioned...
Yeah, you know.
You have a Batman lanyard.
Today, I'd like to recommend the Batman soundtrack. Oh, boy. The story goes that both Warner Brothers and Prince needed a hit. The original plan was for Prince and Michael Jackson to be on the soundtrack, which sounds awesome.
No. Ugh. That does not sound awesome.
Okay, it sounds awesome to me.
It's awesome on this side.
Yeah, that's
Michael
right.
Jackson
yeah.
sucks. Michael Jackson sucks.
So does Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
So does Joss Whedon.
Whoa.
Michael Jackson sucks. Michael Jackson is only good in the context of his era. Prince transcends that era. Michael Jackson sucks.
La, la, la,
it's common knowledge that Prince and Michael Jackson were very polite in public, but privately they were Brian Wilson and
what?
Paul McCartney.
I like that comparison.
Or Davy Jones and Brian Wilson, Davy Jones of the Monkees. Michael Jackson is Davy Jones of the Monkees.
I'm just going to admit here, like, all those records that Quincy Jones wrote that Michael Jackson was on are amazing. Okay.
Yep, see, this side of the table, that's 3-2.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Bill abstains.
Numbers don't matter, the truth matters.
We're going to have a stereo war later.
Yes.
I'm going to have bad, just crank.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'll wear leather and one glove.
It's an appropriate title.
Wow.
But right. At that point, bad meant cool. So
did these
you're right.
sentiments yeah. seem off the
yeah.
wall?
Yeah, so does Dirty Mind.
I don't think there's any comparison. I think Michael Jackson was a one-trick pony, and Prince was not. Prince was not that.
Keep going, Mike.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. I didn't know that. That's the thing that would derail. In order to have full creative control, Prince signed rights away to the songs of the album, which is why, you know, while it is wholly a Prince album, it is not in his greatest hits and is not really mentioned much. I have a friend who likes Prince more than I've ever liked anything in my entire life by a factor of 12.
That's a lot.
Who says, yeah, we know who he is, and who says that Prince fans consider it kind of blah, but I was always a huge fan. Oh boy, why'd I recommend the track Trust? Who do you love? Trust makes you be lover trust. Yeah.
We don't need a clip. I left you it. Just clipped I left, it for us.
Then. Remember the old days when Mike used to sing every episode?
I know. Bring, yeah, I like that.
Trust.
Party man.
Party man.
Trust. Who do ya? Trust. What makes you a real lover? Trust. Put this question to you, cause I want you to be with me.
I could literally do this all day. I love the CD. What do you got, Bill?
Well, mine's just a short, brief story.
Purple Rain?
Supposedly when Prince was in town once, I don't know what it was for. This whole story's vague, but I know it happened. One night, Prince dropped in, and I believe it was at the Bourbon Street Boogie Bar, and played a couple of sets with the band.
Cool.
And he just came, and we got on stage, played a couple of songs, and then he left and waved. The audience, of course, was ecstatic that he came in. And I kind of thought, well, was this urban legend or not? Well, I know it's not because I know the guitar player who was playing on the session and, or on the that night at the club. But I've heard that he would do that. Go to different clubs and just, you know, and go in and just play a couple of songs and then just leave. Cool. And it was just sort of like a fun thing he liked to do. Hey, it's, you know, he just played at like the municipal auditorium to sell out, and he just wanted to get
come down
a little bit and play it to a more intimate crowd. But I just thought that was a cool print story. That's my story.
Cool. Great segue. No, really. I think much like Mike and Jeremy, Prince's music never touched my heart in a really, really personal way, even though I love all the hits. But clearly, I am remiss in this and missing out because all my friends and most of my coworkers are in tears.
It has been surprising.
So clearly, I'm Captain Dum Dum on this particular issue.
It seems like there's a male-female divide, too.
Not all, but
my wife was like inconsolable for a time, and like I said, I didn't come to him till very late, but it seems like all the people that I know that have been the saddest about it have been women and were like fans of him from childhood.
Slight sexism acknowledged.
No. Listen, girl, you can like whatever you like, girl. Why don't you smile more?
That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it's an interesting that
my coworker Susan, who I've mentioned before, was from Minnesota. And I had no idea the lengths to which, holy crap, she wore purple for days.
Yeah.
That's like all she, you know, she had this kind of.
Well,
you know,
but then again, the exception, our friend who likes 12 times more on the power. But yeah, that's a dude.
A burly dude with a beard. So, I haven't noticed that, but you guys know I have an interest in copyright and things like that. And one of the things that I've always admired about Prince is that he always stuck up for artists' rights and his own rights, and he was uncompromising in this. And even just, you know, days before his death, someone asked him on Twitter, like, why aren't your videos on YouTube? And he was like, well, maybe you should ask YouTube why their rates are so crappy. And then that, you know, you'd have a better answer. And I really admired that. And
was he one of the first to really go so public with his, I mean, because when that's why he changed his whole name and wrote Slave on his face. I mean, was he like really the first artist to take a stand and say, this is not fair?
I don't know if it was the first, but when I think back about his career, he's the one that has really consistently and like uncompromisingly, mm-hmm. you know, stood up for artists' rights. And I think that's really important. And like when Taylor Swift and
you can't stream any of his stuff.
And Tom York were anti-Spotify. Everyone was like, these are just spoiled artists. And actually, I was always on their side because the rates on Spotify are like criminal, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that what industry leaders do that. And Prince did that his whole career, not just like for some of his career.
Yeah,
and I think that's really important. And I think maybe this gets to what Jeremy said, like in his main segment too, is also he gave us like a different role for masculinity or a different version of masculinity because he was straight and in charge, but his persona was effeminate mm-hmm. and kind of genderless.
He was teeny.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, he just kind of tore down gender stereotypes in a lot of different ways. And I think that was really important on just totally random other stuff that kind of matters to me. Since he's died, it's been revealed that he funded the Yes We Code program that was like to teach kids how to program computers. It was just, you know, he just gave his money to fund it. Yeah. And I think that was kind of awesome.
He also helped a library in Louisville from closing down, like gave money to keep it open.
Yeah, it was a private donation from him. So
I also like hearing stories like the day he died, there was a public radio station in Minnesota that was live streaming like a lot of his stuff. And they had like stories from the DJs and from regular people. And it was amusing to me just hearing like, I bumped into Prince at Walgreens, you know, that kind of stuff. Like he just seemed like a dude.
He also died on the Queen of England's birthday, and they had lit up Niagara Falls in all purple in honor of her because that's like a royal color. Yeah. But that's Prince color. That's awesome.
Sometimes it's like the universe has a plan. Yeah. All right. Rest in peace, Prince. Now, some stuff is genuinely tickling our fancy, not just stuff we're sad about. So, Amanda?
Okay. Well, I like Prince, but he wasn't huge in my world. So I'm going to talk about something else that was really awesome this week. So I've mentioned that I like to watch HGTV during other Tickle Fancy segments. And so I'm excited because they have a new show. It's called Listed Sisters. why is that funny?
So does Dee Snider show up at some point?
That's Twisted Sister.
Yeah.
Cameo appearance.
Are they going to fight with the Property Bros?
Yeah, it's very much Property Brothers, but it's here in Nashville.
Oh.
Like it's local.
Oh.
Wow. So they work, their office is actually in East Nashville. It's called Lava Designs. And the sister's name are Lex LeBlanc and her twin, Alana. So
it did sound like super villainous. Alana LeBlanc.
Alana Lex. That's a lot.
Her last name might be different because they're married to other people. So it might not be LeBlanc. Well. So anyway, so the show just debuted in March. I think it's fun to watch because you see all the footage of Nashville. Like there's a lot of B-roll stuff of downtown and, you know, all the local parks and areas. They don't always show exactly where the house is, which is probably good because crazy people like me would drive by and try to find it. But I like to try to guess and figure out which part of Nashville they're in. But here's the most just awesomest part. My new house was on the show.
Whoa!
Yeah, party on. So, okay, so admittedly it happened before we moved in. The person who owned our house actually let the sisters shoot at the house as a potential new house for the family they were working with. So it's on the episode that aired April 25th, and it's the first house the family looks at in the Cane Ridge community, and that's all mine.
That's awesome.
Cool.
So
do you want that to be out there in the public?
They can find me. It's a big it's a big house complex. So I will say it was a little we're in Antioch, so bring it. So it was a little weird to be in the house watching the house on TV, especially since I've repainted like every room actual colors because the previous owner had painted everything beige.
Oh.
So I was – and I was really rooting for the family to pick my house, but I'm glad they didn't so I could buy it.
This is like some alternate history. If they picked your house, you wouldn't live in it.
They liked it. They were like, this is really great, but they ended up buying new construction.
Is that how you found your house? No.
No, we found it separately, but like when we had our listing, it said featured on the HGTV show Listed Sisters, and I've been watching it, and I haven't seen it. And then this week, it was on the credits at the beginning. I'm like, that's my house!
Wow.
That's awesome.
Crazy.
So yeah, so if you want to watch Listed Sisters airs on HGTV on Monday nights at 7.
Cool.
You can see my house.
Y'all famous.
I know. I have peed in the bathroom that has been on TV.
I can see my house from here.
Who else can say that? I mean, come on.
Oh, I have a correction.
Tell us, Jeremy.
What?
Brian, you said that the creator of Adventure Time was Pendleton Ward, but it's Pendleton Ward, not Pendleton.
You are truly history's greatest monster.
That's true. So some other things that I wanted to point out, these are addendums. Interesting piece about, you know, successful creative types who used to play D&D. But what's interesting about that is those big long list of people I mentioned, there aren't any women in there. It was all dudes. but maybe that's changing. The full Coates interview is no longer available for streaming from the Pop Culture Happy Hour website, so I couldn't link to it. The short sort of abbreviated interview that was on All Things Considered is up, but it doesn't have that awesome quote about D&D in it.
Oh, sad face.
It's real. It exists. I heard it. Any other addendums?
No.
Good.
No,
good.
I think we did good.
Good. That means we did good. For more information, go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
You can subscribe to the Popmatic podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or via RSS. Next week?
Privacy.
All right, I didn't say anything because I was being private about my answer.
I didn't want you to know
what
we're doing.
Mr. Robot.
Yeah.